From Texas to New York, Minnesota to Louisiana, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, taxpayers continue to provide considerable perks and subsidies to presidents after they leave office. Damian Brady from the National Taxpayers Union is here with details. The Schumer shutdown has begun as U.S. Senate Democrats refuse to provide the votes needed to keep the federal government running. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Will the partial government shutdown result in less spending? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jeremy Dalrymple of the R Street Institute. And real estate taxes are frequently viewed as the most oppressive form of taxation. Will owners get any relief? Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Once presidents leave office, they immediately receive generous taxpayer-funded benefits to run their post-presidency offices. Damian Brady is Vice President of Research at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. He joins us now with details. Damian, welcome to American Radio Journal. Damian, American taxpayers continue to subsidize or pay for the operational costs of presidents once they leave the Oval Office. Can you give us a bit of an overview as to exactly what it is that we, the taxpayers, provide?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and a lot of people don't know about this perk that former presidents get when they're done serving in the White House, and history behind it is very interesting. It goes back to Harry Truman. When he left the White House, he was pleading poverty, telling everybody in Washington, D.C. that he was just down on his luck financially. He needed some help. He could not deal with all the mail requests he was getting for speeches and correspondence, things like that. So this Former President's Act was enacted to provide offices for former presidents. So this perk includes funding for an office space. It could be located anywhere in the country. There's no limit on the size of it. You get staff, funding for equipment, shipping, stamps, things like that. And it turned out, after he passed away, after his widow passed away and the family papers became more available, analysts went through that, and it turns out he had a significant amount of wealth worth more than $70 million in today's dollars. So this whole perk was established basically on a fraudulent premise that he was poor, but it's completely obsolete in the modern era. You know, Truman was very wealthy in the modern era. All the former presidents, extremely wealthy, have lots of opportunities to make money in the private sector. But this perk lives on, and all told, we're spending about $5 million a year on average to provide for the office space and staff and all the perks that go along with that. And that includes the generous pension that they get as well.
Are there any limits to this spending, Damian, or is it up to the former presidents themselves to determine, for example, how much they're going to spend on office space and other, as you put it, perks of the office?
Yeah, they can locate it anywhere in the country that they want. There's really no limit on the amount of rent that taxpayers would be providing for this. So they tend to be located in higher rent areas, so there's no limit on that. And oftentimes, too, the presidents will also locate their office of the former president nearby where they have a foundation. So it's unclear what sort of commingling is going on. Now, there is a limit on the pension that is set at the annual salary for a cabinet secretary, and that gets adjusted every year.
Taking a look back in history, you say all this started with Harry Truman. So, for example, Ulysses S. Grant, he left office. He was virtually impoverished when he did. He didn't get such support when he left?
No, nothing like this was established until the late 1950s. You know, I was just reading a book about George Washington, and after he left the White House, and lots of stuff going on in the history of the Republic at the time, everyone wanted his advice and counsel. So he had visitors pretty much every day that he had to entertain and feed and take care of, in addition to dispensing knowledge to them. I think he had some family members help him out with some expenses like that, but nothing was provided from the federal government until the 1950s. You know, and one question about this is, A lot of it is dealing with correspondence that they get, helping them gather their papers so they can write their memoir. And these are all ways that the former presidents can go out and earn money. They can get paid a couple hundred grand for any speech that they give. They get significant bonuses, signing deals for the memoirs that they publish. So, you know, it's really time to revisit this perk and save taxpayers some money.
I would assume, Damian, that these funds are in addition to the fact that former presidents rightfully receive Secret Service protection, which I'm assuming is a pretty penny to cover that as well.
Correct. And the $5 million that I noted excludes any Secret Service protection costs. That's all unknown to the public. So that help protect the secrecy of those operations. Any reform, there's have been some reforms introduced in Congress, but not touching the Secret Service protection at all.
Modern presidents, of course, tend to have a library. A number of them are, in fact, buried or interred at their library. Harry Truman, as you mentioned, he is one of them, actually had an opportunity to visit the Truman Library and Gravesite here a few weeks ago. Very impressive facility. Do any of these dollars help subsidize those operations, or are they completely separate?
That's a separate deal run by the National Archives. So there is some money provided for the upkeep of the presidential libraries, if they are part of the presidential library system that the archives manages. So, you know, there's been a lot of news lately about the Obama Center in Chicago, and it often gets referred to as a library. But technically, his is not a presidential library. At first, it was going to be. So after he left the White House, National Archives took all of his papers, shipped them to Chicago, and had them stored in a warehouse. But then he decided he was going to do something different and not house any of his documents at the library. So after the pandemic cleared up, all those documents were eventually transferred back to a National Archives facility outside of Washington, D.C. So things like that going forward can save taxpayers money, because then we're not spending extra money to keep the library up to shape for maintenance issues and all the architectural standards that go into making sure that documents are properly preserved within.
Vice presidents, when they leave office, do they receive any sort of compensation for maintaining their offices in their post-vice presidency?
They don't get any perks like that at all. Now, depending on how long they served in Congress, they can get their congressional pension. So, you know, President Biden is a very interesting example of this, because he gets the presidential pension, which is, as I said, is equal to the cabinet secretary's salary, which is about $250,000. And then he also served 44 years in the Senate, and that includes 8 years as vice president, which is an office of the Senate. So he gets a dual pension, which is very unique. So combined, he's making, if he maximized his pension while he was in the Senate and as vice president, he can get a pension worth up to $417,000 a year, which is more than the president collects in his annual salary.
We have been talking with Damian Brady, who is vice president of research at the National Taxpayer Union Foundation. Damian, tell us a little bit about NTU, and also you have written on this subject. Where can folks find that?
Yeah, NTU Foundation is the research arm for the National Taxpayers Union. I work a lot on budget transparency, making sure that lawmakers and taxpayers have reliable cost estimates from the Congressional Budget Office so we can make sound decisions to rein in the out-of-control spending. And you can find our work at ntu.org.
Damian Brady of the National Taxpayer Union Foundation. Damian, thank you for taking time to be with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, which, unlike the federal government, remains open for business. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be with you, Loman.
Of course, the topic of the day, the federal government partial shutdown as a result of the failure of Democrats to put up votes for a continuing resolution. Scott, want to give us the lay of the land as to where the continuing resolution discussion stands at this point?
October 1st at 12:01 a.m., the federal government officially entered a partial government shutdown, which means that essential services continue, but non-essential federal employees have been furloughed. You know, there is an order from OMB Director Russ Vogt to do a reduction in force and to riff unnecessary employees and to cut federal programs and work directly with federal agencies to make government efficient. And what the Democrats have been doing here is really just political theater. Everybody remembers during the Biden administration, there were 13 different continuing resolutions that everybody voted for. There were no government shutdowns. Republicans wanted to obviously hamstring the Biden administration, but they kept government open. And it's been 6.5 years since we've had a government shutdown in early 2019. So this instance is a situation where the House of Representatives, Republican majority, and one Democrat, Jared Golden from Maine, voted to extend appropriations through a CR all the way through November 21st. That bill has been filibustered by the Senate Democrats. Senate Democrats want to repeal various sections of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, including to provide illegal aliens with health care, and also to do an extension of the Obamacare premium tax credit. Those tax credits were expanded upon during the Biden administration as a response to try to help people offset increased healthcare costs during COVID. But COVID's over, and those credits, those subsidies, expire at the end of 2025. And it's not even something that expired at the end of the fiscal year. They're still ongoing for a few more months. But Democrats are trying to draw their line in the sand there. Chuck Schumer, and this is the Schumer shutdown, he's feeling the heat from the radical progressive base led by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and these socialists and communists in their party that were so upset with Schumer for caving in March when I think he and 9 other Senate Democrats, and you know, if you want to call Angus King an independent, they voted to keep government open. So there's been a couple of test votes on what's known as a motion to reconsider, but only a handful of Democrats have voted with the Republicans so far. Now we're seeing Russ vote sort of flex the muscle of what the executive branch can do in the Office of Management and Budget. The first thing that he announced was that he was rescinding the ability for $18 billion of infrastructure projects in New York City from going forward. Is it a coincidence that the senator from New York, Chuck Schumer, is leading the Schumer shutdown? Probably not. And then the second thing that they announced were 18 different states that all voted for Kamala Harris are going to have their Green New Scam programs rolled back and halted permanently. So the Democrats are going to have to decide how much are they going to enable President Trump and Russ Vought at OMB to fulfill the Trump agenda and to have an efficient government that roots out waste, fraud, and abuse and addresses the essential needs of government to the American people, whether it's paying our veterans, continuing Social Security checks. All of those are still ongoing, and it can be hard when you're living paycheck to paycheck. But that's why Democrats need to come to the table and vote with the Republicans to extend the appropriations through November.
And it should be pointed out here, Scott, that Republicans in the House, led by Speaker Johnson, have in fact passed a continuing resolution.
They did. And, you know, it was a CR to November 21st. The Republican majority, along with Jared Golden, voted yes on that bill. There were no anomalies except for one minor provision that enhanced security for members of Congress, the Supreme Court, and senior officials in the executive branch following the terrible assassination of Charlie Kirk. I don't think anybody is objecting to that money, but what the Democrats are trying to do is have this fake shutdown fight over funding for illegal aliens and, you know, really trying to disrupt the ability to enact and go forward with the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and the cuts that we have to the Medicaid program that throw off healthy, able-bodied individuals and try to return that program to its primary purpose of serving children that are in poverty and adults that are disabled and pregnant women. There's also a Medicare program that can take care of people, but the Medicaid expansion underneath Obamacare is really funding these healthy individuals that need to get into the workforce. And it should not just be on the backs of states and the federal government to fund the healthy, able-bodied population. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act rolled that provision back. It saves hundreds of billions of dollars, and Democrats are furious over that and the funding for illegal aliens.
in line with what's usually the Democrat theory of let no crisis go to waste, the Trump administration here does have an opportunity, Scott, does it not, to reduce the federal workforce, because the fact that there is no budget gives them the opportunity to not lay off, but actually eliminate a number of jobs.
Well, Kevin Hassett is in charge of the National Economic Council. He gave an interview earlier this week where he said, hey, when these positions do not have an appropriation to pay the workers, of course, then the federal government, the executive branch, has the ability to not just furlough employees, but also to eliminate positions. And I think that's a pressure point for a lot of Democrats. You know, obviously, federal workers represent a large part of state economies when it comes to state revenues. I think I heard that Maryland had about 12% of their state revenues come from federal workers, and significant in the Commonwealth of Virginia, where I live as well. But not just in the Beltway area, but all throughout America, there are federal agencies that have offices and workers that are being affected right now by the Schumer shutdown. I think it's already over 1.5 million workers that have been furloughed, and that number is going to increase as the shutdown continues.
We, of course, will continue to track this with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We are united in the idea of a limited government that protects our God-given rights underneath the Constitution. If anybody wants to check us out, the website is clubforgrowth.org. You can actually sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again.
You're welcome.
Continuing our coverage of the federal government shutdown, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jeremy Dalrymple of the R Street Institute about the impact on spending.
Starting at midnight on Wednesday morning, the federal government shut down. And a government shutdown is, of course, never quite as comprehensive as that term might suggest. A lot of government programs just keep right on functioning despite the budget impasse in Congress. But nevertheless, this is the big story in federal policy this week and potentially for a few weeks to come. Who knows how long this will drag on for, and there will be some serious repercussions for regular Americans as well that will be felt sooner or later. But is this the path to actually reducing the size and cost of government, or is this all just a big distraction? That's the question that I will ask my guest today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Jeremy Dalrymple. He is the Associate Director for the Governance Program at the R Street Institute. I think it's his first time on the show here, so we're glad to welcome you to American Radio Journal. Jeremy, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Eric, and glad to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here, Jeremy. We are at this point, you know, we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, full disclosure. By the time anybody out there is listening to it, it's very possible that the government shutdown could be over, or this could go on for weeks. We don't know. But as I was driving into the city this morning, I noticed the traffic was still as heavy or maybe even heavier than usual. It didn't seem like Washington, D.C. had just like ground to a halt. And I guess that's a pretty good metaphor for the way these government shutdowns work. I mean, they're not really complete shutdowns by any means.
Almost never. That's one of the key things that they always say, that it's more of a slowdown than an actual shutdown.
Yeah, before we get into more of the big picture stuff, if you can just quickly bring us up to speed here for people who haven't been paying attention, how did we end up in this situation? Like, why is this shutdown happening?
Absolutely. So just giving a little bit of a background real quick. So Congress failed to fund the government before the end of the fiscal year, which was September 30th at midnight. So now we've rolled on to October 1st, and the government is not funding. So that's triggered the first government shutdown since 2019. Where we stand right now is the House of Representatives had approved a CR, which is a continuing resolution, that would have funded the government through November 21st, I believe. The Senate had taken it up. However, because of a unanimous consent agreement, it required 60 votes to approve it. And when they voted on it last night, the vote was 55 to 45. So they weren't able to hit that 60 vote threshold, so they weren't able to pass it. And because of that, the government has now shut down.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, look, we are, less than 24 hours in as we are talking right now. Sometimes these shutdowns go on for just a few days. Sometimes they go on for a week or two. No no clear sense yet of exactly how long this could drag out for. We're chatting with Jeremy Dalrymple. He is the Associate Director of the Governance Program at the R Street Institute. Jeremy, let's zoom out a little bit here, kind of big picture thing. Look, I'm a libertarian. I don't like a lot of the stuff the government does. I think the government does a lot of things very poorly, that it does a lot of things it shouldn't be doing in the first place. So when I hear the phrase government shutdown, there is a part of me, an emotional part of me, that is just like, you know, yeah, this sounds great. Shut it down. Get rid of it. We can deal without it. You know, it doesn't really matter. But I've been around long enough now to have gone through a bunch of these things. You have too. And, you know, I don't know. Is there a track record here to suggest that these shutdowns actually move us towards, say, a smaller or more efficient or less expensive government?
The way it's worked in the past is the obligations are still there. After the 2019 shutdown, Congress had passed a law mandating that everyone that was furloughed during this time would receive back pay. So everyone's still going to be paid. It's going to be a temporary thing. In fact, there are a lot of other grants that are not paid through the appropriation process are still going to be going out the door. And a lot of other things are just going to still be piling up.
Yeah, I mean, to that same point, then, we've heard a lot this week from the Trump administration, from the director of the Office of Management and Budget, for example, talking about how there could be mass layoffs of federal employees if this goes on for a while. Again, sounds like, you know, that could be a positive development here. Yeah, we should have fewer people working in the federal government. But I wonder, you know, again, does that actually get us towards a government that spends less, that borrows less? Or that seems like something that ultimately has to come from Congress rather than the executive branch, right?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things I really want to focus on is Congress as the first branch and the ability to restore them to their rightful place. The founders, when they were drafting the Constitution, put the budget in the control and in the hands of Congress. And Congress can't delineate that duty. It shouldn't get rid of it. It's what they're actually paid to do. And bringing that up to Congress, congressmen and senators are still going to be paid during the shutdown. There were a few people that are exempted from this and will be receiving their salary along with their president. But yeah, when you brought up the reduction in forces, the RIF, so we've seen statements come out from OMB and OPM on this. And really what it is there is they're talking about this is a result of the appropriation process being broken and appropriations actually not taking place. They're saying, hey, look, we're having to do this reduction in force because you didn't pass the appropriation bills on time. And they've even, and OPM put in one of their memos that came out and said, hey, if you actually fund the government and start it back up again, we might not necessarily be doing these reduction in forces. It's really involved in Congress's court right now.
Yeah, it seems like that's the case with just like so many of the problems that are facing the country right now, facing the federal government, at least right now. It always seems to come back to like Congress's inability to pass a budget, Congress's inability to do the one thing that it really is supposed to do and care about and focus on, and that is handle the fiscal affairs of the federal government. And until that changes, I don't think it's going to change anytime soon, but until it does, we will continue to have these types of situations. Jeremy, that's unfortunately all the time we have for today. Thanks for filling us in on all that. Really helpful, great conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Eric.
And once again, that is Jeremy Dalrymple. He's the Associate Director of the Governance Program at the R Street Institute. Check out their work online at rstreet.org. Follow our ongoing coverage of the government shutdown, if it is indeed still shut down by the time you're listening to this. Find all of that at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Property taxes place a strain on many family budgets, but in some states, relief may be on the way. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this American Radio Journal commentary.
Do you think your property taxes are too high? Are you concerned with the lack of transparency around the process? Well, you're not alone. Long one of the most hated taxes, Americans are seeing property tax bills soar to unaffordable levels. The property tax increases often happen silently until the bill arrives at the doorstep. Even then, homeowners and renters alike are many times totally in the dark when it comes to determining why their costs are escalating, as well as who is driving the burden of government ever higher. Even more troubling are the deceitful proclamations from many local politicians who say they've held the line on our property taxes this year, all while property tax bills increase for hardworking taxpayers. How can that be? Well, property taxes have a major honesty gap problem. That problem comes from a difference between how taxes are calculated by local governments and how they're paid by taxpayers. The problem is multiplied by the desire some local politicians have to escape the well-deserved political liabilities that come with the overspending at the local level, the spending that drives nearly all property tax burdens across the country. For most of the nation, property tax bills are determined by multiplying a local tax rate by the property's assessed value. While that tax rate is set by the government, the property value can fluctuate depending on the market. For example, if the local housing market tightens and a taxpayer's home value goes up, they could be served with a much higher tax bill. Just because their home value goes up, that might not mean that they have any more money to pay the tax, of course. Through all of this, local government did not need to take any action because the tax increase is due to the higher property valuation assigned by the government. When asked, local government officials will even say that they didn't increase the property taxes because the rate set has not changed. At best, this half-truth, of course, ignores the fact that the local government sent out those higher bills and pocketed the windfall revenue from the assessment increases. Even worse, some big spending local officials excel in shifting the blame to the state level and claim that state lawmakers are the cause of the property tax problem since they didn't send local governments enough aid. However, when you look at the tax collections data, it becomes clear that nearly all property taxes across the nation are driven by local units of government. This situation, in which many communities around the country find themselves in, is obviously not serving the interests of the taxpayer. It just leads to compounding confusion and financial pain, but it is a windfall for those who would like to spend more and grow government at the local level. Some states, recognizing these problems, have implemented a solution called Truth in Taxation, which we at ALEC endorsed as model policy. This policy was pioneered decades ago by fiscally prudent states like Utah and Tennessee, is based on the principle that government exists not for the sake of collecting taxes, but to provide certain core functions to its taxpayers. To do this, Truth in Taxation requires honesty and transparency. Local taxing authorities need to calculate the tax rate that would provide them with the same amount of revenue as the previous year after the assessment changes are made. The default becomes for taxes not to increase, but if they do increase, local officials must be clear about why and hold themselves accountable for such decisions. If the local taxing authority wants to collect more money, it can do so, but it must do a few simple things. It must provide notice to taxpayers, hold a public hearing, and take a recorded vote of the appropriate local officials. By creating a transparent starting point each year, it ensures taxpayers and officials mean the same thing when they talk about increasing property taxes or keeping them the same. But without these reforms, property taxes have a major honesty gap problem. Bills continue to rise with property values while local governments pocket those windfall revenues, all while taxpayers are stuck in the dark. In order to break out from this current failed system of property taxes across America, state and local leaders must fundamentally bring spending side discipline to the equation for local governments. Make no mistake, local spending decisions determine property tax burdens. Bringing real transparency and accountability to that reality is exactly what hardworking American taxpayers deserve. For more information on how your state can achieve meaningful property tax reform, you can visit ALEC.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WGAWAM in Gardner, Massachusetts. Welcome to our new listeners in the Bay State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.